have several courses, you know, after lunch. And one person was a very famous historian, kind of like Harry Reisner, you know, had been in the French embassy when things happened. But he lectured in a monotone. And so you're trying to stay awake. And so I put my hand down like this. And all of a sudden I jerked and I slammed my fist down on the desk.
Right, I'm with you, I'm with you.
Or I wanted to be in. Goes to sleep. So now I'm going to take you to my signature text. Some texts in the Bible become signature texts. And I spent a lot of time in this one. And it's not in the Psalms. But whenever you get poetry, again, the narrative is given in the theology. So this poem is right at the center of the Samuel books. Takes Hannah's theology, personalize it for an event that David had in his life. And actually, I'm going to let you hear it on James Garcia, my worship pastor, put it to music. And in your book, it is on page 56. So did I not have the music on there? It fell off again. Shame on you. You got it? I'll find it. Hey.
Until the new season.
So David challenges us that growing spiritually has everything to do with how we embrace loss and limitation and grief. And at the core of it, finding a mystery of love that keeps us going when our dreams are shattered. My first experience with grief came on a beautiful fall day in November. I was 12 years old, painfully shy introvert, entering my adolescent years, carefully trying to tiptoe my way unnoticed by my intimidating peers. We were assembled in a co-ed gym class doing square dancing. So you actually had to touch a girl's hand. And our awkward attempts at dancing were interrupted by the principal, who announced over the loudspeaker, "The president has been shot." We stood numb, frozen in silence, and then came a second announcement, "The president has been shot and killed." So how do adolescents cope with an announcement like that? So the teachers consulted, they went over the corner like a bunch of little chicken and hens trying to figure out what to do, dazed. So they concluded it was best that we continue dancing. And anyone who felt it was inappropriate could sit out by themselves. Well, stepping out from the crowd was not something I was courageous enough to do, so I continued to dance, and I watched a couple of my friends sit on the side, and I thought, they are very courageous. But I remember the dancing, it was like a dance of corpses, kind of swimming in a chaotic world. It was surreal. My next class was English. I remember we're waiting at the door. The door's locked. And we watch Mr. Dunleavy walk across the lawn. And he's walking like a soldier. And he just sits his head down. And he's just delivered. And he goes, "The troops must go on. The troops must go on." And we had English as usual. And I thought, well, and he says, "You know, when a troop falls in battle, the troops go on." And I thought, well, this is not an ordinary troop. This is the President of the United States has just been assassinated. But we had English. No mention of death whatsoever. So after school, my mom insisted we go shopping to buy me a pair of pants. There's a little men's store on Ventura Boulevard in the San Fernando Valley that we went to. And as I walked into the men's store, I heard the Catholic rosary on, doing Hail Marys. And I felt like I was violating some holy space as my mother's looking for pants. She was not a Democrat and didn't like the president, so I guess shopping was okay with her. So she's trying to buy me the pants. There's all this tension in the store. And all of a sudden, the owner steps out from behind the counter, breaks the tension, turns the sign around, closed. And we went out. And my mother was angry all the way home. How could she not buy a pair of pants for her son on this day? And that night, alone in my bed, those haunting tones of the rosary kept echoing in my ears. And I felt unclean, like I had violated something unknown, holy boundary. But lest those holy drones penetrate too deeply, they were quickly drowned out on Sunday when the National Football League games continued uninterrupted. So that was the day the president was shot, and I was never allowed to acknowledge grief. I was told to keep dancing, studying, shopping, and playing. And that was the day I learned how to use silence to confront the dark demon of death, just erect a wall of denial, and the dreaded beast will never come back, and he'll go into the abyss from which it came. Or will it stay there? Well, David was in Ziklag, and he got the news that Saul and Jonathan were killed on Mount Gilboa. Saul was decapitated. His weapons were carried off as trophies for display in the Philistine temple of Ashtaroth, while his body and the bodies of his sons were nailed and impaled on a wall in Beit Shan. A valiant group of men from Jabesh Gilead pulled a right raid. I think I have a view of Beit Shan. A slide. What do we got? Tears of the night. Keep going. Well, actually, let me start here. I'll start here about the context. You have two men, Jonathan and David. They've got two different families. They were chosen from two different destinies, but they were united for one cause. Okay, next slide. So they have four encounters of friendship. And we have the birth of friendship, what united them. Friendship is sealed, what deepened their friendship. Friendship sustained, and then friendship immortalized in this poem. Next slide. So you're probably familiar with this passage. This occurs after David killed Goliath. So up until this point, Jonathan's first encounter with the Philistines is he single-handedly, with his armor bearer, killed a whole regiment. This time he's like a starting quarterback and he's sitting on the bench and he's watching somebody else do it. And when he sees David's power and tenacity and spirit, he falls in love with him. And he says, I'm going to spend the rest of my life serving him. I'm not going to be king. He's going to be king. And he loves David as himself. And he strips and gives David his armor. And it's nothing that he chose to do. It's just his soul was knit to him. It's an internal thing that happens when you see something of beauty and awe. And you just want to give your life to a bigger cause than yourself. It's interesting. You want to trace what greatness is according to the life of Jonathan. It's the opposite of what the American way is. The first case, when he faces the Philistines, he's the victor, sorry, quarterback. The second case, he's on the bench. And the third time, he's killed. And that's victory in the kingdom. Next slide. And so as a warrior, David, like Jonathan, lived with an oppressive family atmosphere. David fought not for himself, but for his king. David did not assess the battle by what he saw, but by what he heard. Did you ever know how David won that battle? Very subtle. What did Saul want David to do? Saul wanted David to use his armor to fight Goliath like a warrior. David was not a warrior, he was an animal tamer. So he tells Saul what he's done as an animal tamer by the Spirit. He tamed the bear, he tamed the lion, and God will make this Philistine just like them. So I'm not going to fight on those terms of a warrior. That's Goliath's game. If you want to fight the world, the world's way, the world will kill you. They got better lawyers, they got more money and more power and more strength, and they will kill you. You have to fight the battle a different way as a civilian. So now we determine we have two people coming out. David's going to fight as a civilian. He's an animal tamer. He's got his stones. He's got his sling. He comes to the battle, and here's Goliath. Who determines how the battle is fought? Whoever determines that, that's going to decide the course of the battle. First words out of Goliath's mouth. You know what they were? Am I a what? A dog. You come up with the sticks? Ah, David's an animal tamer. Yes, you are a dog. Battle's won. And David figured out the battle not by what he saw. All of Israel saw the armor. They operated by the eye gate. David operated by what he heard. He heard Goliath blaspheme God. Battle's over. It's the Lord's battle. And then you probably don't know really where that stone went because it's ambiguous. But when they start listing the armor from top to bottom, it lists all these things, then it lists the shin guard. And the Hebrew word for forehead is the same word as the shin guard. So the last word you heard was shin guard in that stone. The one place where Goliath was vulnerable was there was an opening in the shin. And if you got hit in the forehead with a baseball at 100 miles an hour, would you fall forward or backwards?
Backwards.
How does Goliath fall?
Forwards.
Where he threw that ball was in the shin guard, and now he's rendered his armor inoperative. He's Jolly Jean Grant. He can't walk. And the very thing that's to make him strong now makes him weak, and he just falls forward. Goliath, David comes and cuts off his head. I don't know why any translator doesn't do that. It's in the text. That's the Hebrew word. It's just brilliant narrative stories. They're great language, no big words. Anyway, that impressed Jonathan. He doesn't fight the world's way. So David knew that faith in the living God plus initiative would grant victory to a 17-year-old. Okay, next slide. Now, here's the most beautiful scene. There's four scenes that occur when they seal their friendship. And this is a great story about how you operate with love and friendships. David is very discerning. He can see right through motives. I am like Jonathan's like me. He is naive. He believes the best about people. He takes people at face value. He's an optimist. He's, you know, I believe you love me until you shoot me in the shoulder. I'm lying there in a bull. I guess they don't like me. And if they know me, they really like me. And then they shoot you again. They realize, I guess they have another agenda. Yeah, my life as a pastor. So when David tells Jonathan, your father wants to kill me. And Jonathan says, no, he doesn't. He just made an oath to me that you're not going to die. That's an oath. Now, Saul doesn't keep one oath he makes in the whole Bible except the oath he makes to a witch at the end of his life. But Jonathan believes of dad and takes an oath. So David says, he then backs it up and he swears himself. Now you've got two oaths back to back. Now who gives? So Jonathan says, okay, what do you want me to do? I'm going to let down my perspective in life and let me see life from your point of view. Now that's a loving thing to do between husbands and wives, or when you're loggerheads, you can't keep pushing. Someone has to back away and say, let me see life from your point of view. That's why I have people tell their stories. Let me just go up the mountain like you went up the mountain. Let me just hear your story. So David says, okay, I'll raise life for you. I know how to do this. We'll get to roll raise the chessboard. I'm going to put you at the table, and here's Saul, and here's the general. That's where I'm supposed to be, and here's you, and you're going to mouth my words, and you're going to be me, and I know how to bring out Saul's hidden intentions, and when that happens, you'll really see. So Jonathan's willing to play the game. Now that's a loving thing, to lay down your perspective and admit you might be wrong and be a different perspective. Now you're going to play the game. So the game gets set up, and Saul's wondering. Next day the whole thing happens. And then Jonathan goes a step further. He even uses the word escape. And he uses the very language that David said to him. He takes David's role. And Saul's so angry, he calls his son a bastard. And disowns him in speech. And then comes the arrow, the spear. He's not a very good aim. There's nothing but bullet holes in his wall. He never hits anything. The only time the sword hits its mark is when he falls on his own sword. But when that sword goes over, Jonathan goes, okay, I think I know my father's going to kill him. That's what it takes for naive people like me to think people are going to pray. And then what happens, Jonathan has to make a choice. Who where does his allegiance go? He gets up from the table and he disowns his father in action. I'm going to serve David the rest of my days. And he goes out to the field and they have this very moving thing. And he realizes, he says, look, David, I know this might cost me my life. So here's the will. When I die, if I die, you take care of my wife and the kids. Sign it. And that's how they left. And then Jonathan knew he had a different destiny. He has to go down the sinking ship. And David, you're going to be king. Take care of my kids. Well, who do you think wept more? David did. And that's the kind of love I had in Iranian. Four men named Jonathan. And this Jonathan's wife, Lee. It's a beautiful woman. She's tough. I found out when I got, this is like 20 years later, I found out 3 years ago. Securitate came to her house and said, you have foreigners in your house. She said, I did not have foreigners in the house. I only have family. Mm-hmm. And they said, no, there were foreigners in their house. He said, well, we're coming to your house. She says, you're not welcome in my house. You're not family. I mean, she's standing up to like this, you know, KGB Securitate, they would kill you, they're orphans, they don't care anymore. So they're coming to the house, she calls her husband, they have all these Bibles hidden in the basement. Hundreds of Bibles. And now the Securitate, a little bit like the Keystone Cops, they have to get a witness. So the witness is a neighbor who happens to be a Christian. So they have to have two witnesses. So they go and they search the house, they find nothing. What's this thing? Down in the basement. The Christian witness goes down there, Securitate answers, do you see anything? No. I don't see anything. Says to the agent, do you see anything? No, I don't see anything. God made eyes blind. I don't know what happened, but she risked her life for me. And at one point, I thought, one guy was walking ahead of us 500 yards, this elitist out. And I put some money in his shoe to leave it. I thought we got caught because I saw the secure top they covered and he was gone. And I thought he ended up in jail because of me. So four men named Jonathan said, they will go to prison for me. When you come home, you're not the same. And that's what David felt. That someone is going to die for me. And he did. He did. So every time he puts his crown on, he thinks, this king of blood, the king's son, died for me that I could be king. There's a lot of emotion there. So next slide. Next slide, we just go through these. We're done. That was good enough. Thank you. Next slide. So that's where, this is where they impaled the bodies, and then an Entebbe raid came and rescued them. Next slide. Oh, my Hebrews doesn't come out again. I forgot to make another thing. Anyway, go back. Yeah. So here's the deal. For the first time in 13 years, David could come out in the open and dance and be free and celebrate his kingdom. He doesn't do that. He says, I'm going to lament. And I want all the nation to lament with me. Now, when this poem goes into sacred scripture, that means anyone reading this text has to take this lament and lament with David. It's a very honoring thing when we enter into somebody's pain. For 3,000 years, David wants us to weep with him. That's a gift. If you're a Jew, you lose a friend for 1 year, and you go to synagogue, they say Kaddish. Everybody who's lost somebody stands up, and that entire congregation with you weeps with you for 1 year. So why in the church do we say, aren't you over a week later? It's resurrection. Your kid's in heaven. I don't want my kid in heaven. So he tells them to teach, it's a very interesting thing with these word plays. Teach your sons of Judah the song of the bow. The word bow is also a homonym with the word kashet, which is harsh. It's almost, teach your sons the harsh realities of life. Make them sing. So, usually I have somebody chant this at this point, but we heard James say, does anybody want to chant the poem? Who has the best voice here? Who?
So not qualified to choose.
Come on up here, Marilyn. Come on up here, I'll have this. Come on. It's in the text, so we're kind of stuck. I'm sorry.
I think she's our scapegoat, really.
I know it. Give me one name, I can't learn anymore. At my age, I'm only good for one name. So what you can do is just kind of let this go. Your beauty, O Israel, this thing I play. Just try that. Just go through and see what comes out of you. And don't have to do the parentheses. Just do it.
Gazelle, O Israel, is slain on your high places.
Give a little more chin. Stretch out the vowel.
How have the mighty fallen?
You sell like Saturday Night Live.
Ashkelon.
The Hebrew is actually easier.
Lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult.
That's good. One more verse.
O mountains of Gilboa, may you have neither dew nor rain. May no showers fall on your terraced fields. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul no longer rubbed with oil.
Concerned with not what it was saying, but how it was saying. And I was really trying to look at the dynamics of how David was processing his grief. And if you go to page 61, I kind of discovered there was this four processes happening here in his soul. And so I put this A, B, C, D. But what happens is that first he has to name the grief. Give it a name. Then he has to move it through the soul. It can't stay stagnant. If grief stays stagnant, it freezes over. And if it freezes over, you don't have any feelings of joy or anything. Once the grief is spent, the pain is surprisingly purged and is transformed into love. Sacred love. And that's what happened to this poem. So, slide. Let's see. Go through the translation. We just sang the whole thing. It was wonderful. Go ahead. Next slide. We did that. Next slide. Oh, that was where that was. Okay. So I'm going to skip the refrain because that happens three times. So the first thing he does is he's giving grief a name. And what he's going to say here is he's impotent to prevent the inevitable. It's sort of like there's certain things in life, if the shoe drops, that's the worst possible thing. So in this case, the shoe dropped, and you can't prevent it from happening. So he says, tell it not in Gath. What was Gath? Who lived in Gath? Goliath's hometown. Okay? So it's like I'm a Stanford guy, I hate USC, especially because I grew up there. And so when we played them, we lost when I was in college, the worst thing that could happen is I had to go past fraternity row and see them celebrating. And, you know, she's from SC, so that's why it's even more painful. So he's saying here, the good news is going to the streets of Ashkelon, the Philistine women's are rejoicing, all the while the daughters of Israel are weeping. So he's juxtaposing two opposites that intensify the pain. So the worst thing for the losing team is to go to the winning team's locker room and see them bursting the champagne and reveling in it. It's interesting, I've read a lot of Elie Wiesel, who's the best writer to come out of the Holocaust. And he writes that 35 years after being in Auschwitz and Birkenau, he went back. And he was shocked by what he saw. He says, Dante knew nothing. He says, hell is a serene splendor that takes your breath away. What he meant by that is all the concentration camps were planted in the most beautiful forests of Europe. He says, then I only saw a barbed wire. It was endless. And as I talked about last night, Paul Celan's poem, that Totus Fuga, having the Jews play Bach while they're digging their grave. How do you juxtapose those two things? And this is what David is doing here in the poem, creating these tensions. Israelite women are sweeping. The Philistine women are rejoicing. I can't prevent that from happening. Next slide. And then the opposite side, he's impotent to create what he wants to create. So he says, you mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew or rain upon you. nor fields of offerings, for there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. In those days, the warriors actually put literal oil on the shield so the arrows would bounce off, but it has a dual meaning. The spirit left Saul and abandoned him long ago. And he was abandoned on Mount Gilboa. So David is writing, if God abandoned his Messiah on this mountain, then this mountain should be cursed. No longer should there be any rain, because rain and dew then give crops. Crops then create offerings. Offerings create worship. This should not be a mountain of worship ever again. But here's what Gilboa really looks like. So that juxtaposition of beauty, where horror happens, is too difficult for David to comprehend. So when my son died, I was on the freeway and on Highway 101, everybody's going to work. And I thought, how can you all go to work when my son died? You want the world to stop. You're always looking for things larger than life to give meaning to the events, significance. Before he died, I noticed, you know, you're just grabbling for stuff, and the sun was setting over San Francisco into the ocean. I thought, you know, the sun's setting in my son's life. Every time my kids died, it was raining. Pouring. That was comforting to me. I felt like the heavens were crying. So that's what David writes, the first thing, in naming his grief. I'm impotent to prevent the inevitable, and I can't impotent to create what I want to create. I can't make this happen. And he expresses then really human inadequacy in the face of death. It's too big for us. Okay, next slide. How far did we go? Go back? Back one? Okay, go. Okay, we're fine. Painful irony in death. Now I'm supposed to know the refrain. Where's the refrain on there? Is that up? Moving briefly, yes. Stay up. Step. Stay, that's right there. Okay. So the second step, once you name the grief, you've got to move it. So moving is a very simple thing. It's called crying. When you're crying, your sides are moving. There's this movement of the spirit. Some people are better at it than others. Crying is a very healthy thing for the body spiritually. Women usually do it easier than men because you're more integrated than men. Your brains are more connected, and emotion comes with a lot of things, and you're more integrated. Men are more bifurcated, so we can shove it, which makes for good soldiers for a while. Then we have post-traumatic stress when it all comes back. But David, don't go there yet. It's a secret. So, David is a master poet. And here's what he has to do to get you to grieve and move this in your soul. He has to take you someplace you don't want to go. No one wants to go to Gilboa to see the slain there, to see decapitated Saul. But he has to get you there for the poem to have reality. So how does he get you there? He gets you there through a thing called curiosity. The very first word in the poem is hatsavi, which is the Hebrew word, it's a homonym. It means beauty, like the crown of Israel, which is Saul. It also means gazelle, the swift-footed gazelle, Jonathan. So if you're a Hebrew listener, you don't know who this poem's about. You don't know, are we reading about the grief? Is this a national event over a dead king? Are we Washington, D.C., watching the president's coffin coming through? Or is this about David's personal grief for his best friend, Jonathan? You don't know. But likely, you're going to assume it's about who? Saul, right? It's the king. Okay, we're at a national event. Okay, so there's refrain. Now, normally, refrains come at regular intervals in a song. But this one, he doesn't give the second refrain almost till the poem's done. And he flips the A and the B lines, and he tells you who the Hatsavi is. Next phrase. How the mighty have fallen in battle, Jonathan. Probably slain in the high places. At that point, the poem turns from third person to personal I, you. And you now find out David wrote this poem in a national assembly, and he's using this poem to process his personal grief with his personal friend in a national context. Think of that. Don't you love it when we were at kind of high political events or grievous things, and a dignitary doesn't become just professional, they become personal and they actually cry. I watched this one police shooting on the news yesterday, the day before, and the cops were crying over their lost friend. I mean, they couldn't talk. Instead of just the perfunctory, you know, this is our David. And then, well, you now realize everything you just saw has now been flipped, and that increases your emotion. And sort of what happened to me in Karen's poem, she got through, everything flipped on me, and I found out the whole thing was personal, and now it's about Jesus, and now the poem has all new meaning, and you're going back thinking about the old images, and there's more emotion in them. So then, he's holding you there, and then he hits you again, flips the lines, how the mighty have fallen, and the weapons of war have perished, and so have those who trusted in them. This is Hannah's theology once again. The strong are brought down, and the poor are raised. That's the way God moves grief. This is one way he did it in this poem. He gets you to where you don't want to go. Makes you think you're looking at what you're not thinking about. All of a sudden it switches the things. I've seen this happen so often, like people can go through death of friends, you know, and then all of a sudden the dog dies. And the dog dies and the switch clicks in and all the pain comes out from the whole thing, all the grief they've had. God is a master at getting you to where you don't want to go. To face what you don't want to face. Okay? Third sign. Okay. Now, grief is spent, pain is purged. Here is the eulogy. This is where eulogy means speak well of somebody. How do you speak well of Saul? So here's what he says. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back. The sword of Saul did not return empty. Saul and Jonathan, in life, they were loved and gracious. In death, they were not parted, swifter than eagles, stronger than lions. In the Hebrew, the word life and death are kissing together. What a juxtaposition. Hayim and Mavet, I mean, they're touching in the Hebrew text. Can't do that in English. So I looked at this for a while, and I go, what is David lying? Saul and Jonathan loved and gracious, and Saul was like Saddam Hussein, killing people and liars and doesn't keep any vows. So here's the thing. Or is this candy-coated adulation that you just do at a funeral because you have to be nice to people? And one time we had this funeral and I walked out, and this old guy was walking out with his wife and he goes, hey Martha, was that really John? It didn't sound like John. You know, because he knew what John was really like and you get all this adulation when you're dead. So here's my feeling. Because David did lament poetry for 10 years before God, God healed him of his angst against Saul. So he could forgive him. And funerals are never the place to vent anger. And there's always something in a person's life that is the image of God that you can put on that altar to thank God for. There's one thing he could say about Saul. There was a time the Spirit was on Saul and he was a good warrior. That's about it. And everything else in there is about Jonathan. But he veils it. It's a formal affair. So he's appropriate. People in the know, though, will know. The thing about poetry, it's subversive. You can be polite and appropriate, but underneath, the real people know what's going on. And so he honors Saul here. Next slide. Nothing he does. What made Saul angry his entire life and jealous of David was what? David comes back from battle and the women are singing, Saul has killed the thousands and David the 10,000s. Now that is just the way you do Hebrew poetry. The servant is on line one, the king is on line two, and you always up the number in the second line by an exponential amount. But when you're paranoid and through the eyes of jealousy, Saul thinks that David is adulated more than him, and it just gets his crawl, and he's angry as hell. So what David says in his death, you want the love of women? You can have it. Here it is. It's a little bit ironic, because he says, daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, and what you're wearing is not appropriate for your funeral. You're in your Beverly Hills ornaments that he gave you. You need to rend those clothes. There's a little bit of irony going on there, a little subtlety of the poet. But he still gives him this gift of love. Because he says, I had something better. What was that? What did David have? was better than the love of women?
Jonathan's
love. Okay, now here's the best thing about poetry. Next line. So here's the real source. Now it gets personal. I'm distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Notice it's not about words here, but everyone is densely packed. Very pleasant you've been to me. Your love is extraordinary, surpassing the love of women. The next slide. So look at that. You. This is the highest terms you can talk about relationship. My brother. Jonathan means gift of God, by the way. You, me. Now, your love. Do I have another slide on extraordinary? Yes. That word is never used of human beings, except here. A pala is a wonder that God does that is awe-inspiring. You know what a wonder is? It's the Exodus. Splitting the waters, bringing Egypt down in 10 plagues. That's awe-inspiring. So he tells Jonathan, your love was divine. And I get very upset with liberal authors that say the guys were gay. So I'll tell them first thing. Okay, first of all, guys, these guys were soldiers. They would kill you if you said that. Secondly, they never were together. Third, you've never experienced holy love like I have. When you've experienced holy love, it transcends any kind of romantic love when people die for you. And I've been this here in hospitals and experienced it. It's a very, one of the holiest moments I ever was with a recent death in our congregation. The guy was about my age, struggling with cancer, and he wasn't afraid to die. He's on his deathbed. The day before, his wife does something, falls or trips, she ends up in the hospital. What the hospital did is they put her in the bed next to her husband, so she could spend the last night with him. Wow. Holy time. Like the holiest moment is when you let that person go and then you see them walking through that transition to the other side. So he says, your love, I've never been loved like that before. Somebody died for me. And I think this helps us understand the cross, because it's hard for us to believe Jesus died for me and it's so abstract. When you get to human relationships, you put it in these terms, you feel it deeply and it helps you understand the cross. So, here is the best gift poetry ever gave me. This is everything I'm going to give you for the conference. This is it. Yeah, this is all you have. You can do a lot of healing. Next slide. Before David writes this poem, this is the situation. Jonathan's dead. Can't bring him back. It's horrific. David was absent. He was not at Gilboa. Who knows where God was? And Gilboa is desecrated. Total desecration. Now look what happens after the poem's written. The poem creates a window. I call it, it transcends time. And in the poem, David, in community, is able to resurrect Jonathan for a moment and talk to him and tell him what he never told. David loved him. David's totally present. There is a holy love going between God and David and Jonathan. And Gilboa is consecrated forever. Now we have a woman in our congregation who heard Elsie's story about being healed in 2 years with songs. She said, I'm going to give you 90 days, God. So she met with Elsie and I for 12 weeks. This is all she knew to do. You go back to a place where you were desecrated, relive it with God in the equation, write a poem, share it. For 12 weeks, on Tuesdays at 2:30, we would listen to her and the poems, 22 poems came out of her. Her mother was demon-possessed. Her father was absent in Puerto Rico and Japan. They got married because they had to. Her first abuse happened in middle school by a high school senior who made her a slave. And then it went all the way on through Stanford years, things I can't even describe. She went back to all those moments, And the places geographically took pictures, and she found out at the middle school, at Mendel School, the places where all these pedophile professors were, the earthquake took it out, and it was all yellow tape. She went back and put songs of praise, recreated the moments. In that 12 weeks, she lost 25 pounds. Her right and left brain got back together. She hadn't played classical music in 25 years, and I just put her in front of the piano with no music, I said, play. And out came Bach, Chopin. And she wrote a book, said, How Lament Saved My Life. She'd been to counselors, this is all she did. So for me, tell you my Gilboa. That's a place I don't like to go. That's where my daughter died. What makes it painful for me is that we didn't do it right. So when David died, the hospital said, well, we'll take care of the body. And you think that's great. You're 23 years old. No one's helping you. I don't have to put the body in the ground and so on. I was smart enough at least to have a memorial service for David, but I don't know where the body is. Jessica happens a year later. And I shut down. When I got the news of Jessica, Emily held her all night on the third night and knew she was going to die. So I came to the hospital and I told my pastor, I said, she's not going to die. I mean, God took our firstborn. It's going to be okay. He looked at me. And I knew he knew, but he couldn't tell me. When I got the ammonia level count, I knew the end. So when I knew the end, I shut down emotionally. And they transferred her to Stanford Hospital. They plugged her full of milk for protein, which really threw her ammonia levels up. So I went to see her on Friday with an elder. And you're reliving everything. When she's all hooked up. I just wanted just to bawl. I was with an elder and I was embarrassed, and so I just stuffed it. So I went home. So I called the next day to see how Jessica was, and they're saying, oh, she expired. No one told me. I felt like, with David, I felt we got to know him because we didn't know in the end. We loved him, we caressed him, we laughed, we cried, we prayed. Jessica, I just... And then she's gone. And then as a pastor, I got to bury other people's kids who really do put the kids to the ground. And they have these markers at Erastadero Cemetery. They go back there every year. And I go, where do I go? Where the sore parenthesis. And so, but God was so gracious. This is 1992. This is 16 years after she died. I get a call to go to Gilboa. To see where I don't want to see. Another boy went down in our church, 6 years old, had a hole in his heart. They gave him ADHD medication, hit his heart like that, and he went down. So I went to see him Friday, and you know, and these parents are showing me how to grieve. So I'm not the pastor. I am learning. I pray, I laugh, they were singing. I go back on a Monday, and then I'm headed home on 280, and the Lord said, turn your car around, have to go back and see what you've never seen out of fear. Now, we've been through a lot of death. My whole wife's family died. Parents died of cancer. Her sister died of AIDS. We cared for them, but I've always missed the moment of death. I miss David's death. So I have a sting of death that sits over me. So I go back and we hold hands around the bed and we sing It's Well With My Soul. And I didn't know the second verse. And there's this beautiful black nurse at the end of the bed. It was Christian. She boomed it out. And when she did, angels came into the room. And this peace that flooded comprehension filled this room, top to bottom, as Timmy died. I mean, this transcendent love filled the room. And I stood there and I watched Dawn, her name. Mom's name was Dawn, caress her son. It was like Mary holding Jesus for like half an hour, just caressed him. And then I watched the nurse prepare the body and wash the body in tenderness. And as I left, the Lord said, That's what you missed when you weren't with your daughter. I was there. So I said, okay, Lord, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to be as radical as David and go off the reservation, and I'm going to use a church service and heal my own grief. So I was preaching on this word, nachat, which means the Lord leadeth me. And it's always leading to danger out the other side. So I just took it that he, at the end, he leads to death. And I said, okay, I'm going to write Jessica a poem. And I'm going to share it. So this was my first step for healing after 16 years. So it's called Let It Rain. Well, Jessica, 9 months we waited. For your precious hidden frame to break through the darkness and turn our souls into day, unto us it was given. Morning came. It's dawn so bright. It loosed our sackcloth and burned us with light. Your form so pure, yours the sweetest gaze, a mother's dream, a father's praise. And on the third night, while I slept, you cried. Your mother held you tight. She knew that it was hidden from me. All through the darkness, she cared for you and then gently laid you upon the altar. She knelt behind those well-hewn stones and wept. And then I heard the chauffeur's ringing cry. Terror-struck, impossible, I cried. Could it be to walk this way again? Conception to pain, never to regain when the firstborn is already paid. I pulled back, but drew, traumatized by the pain I already knew. I could not stay and watch, for now I knew. My eyes could not gaze on your little tent, which would all too soon be broken down and laid to rest in the earth rather than upon the breast. Waves of grief came crashing down. Heaven was calling to the rain. Pour out your heart like water, but I turned and left, numb from pain. Oh, Jessica, 9 months we waited for your precious hidden frame to break through the darkness and turn our souls into day. Oh, Jessica, where are you now? Where did the sower plant the seed I long to know that is hidden from me? Oh, could I now go back in that dark hour we live, where you lay limp and still, I would be your papa and gifts. I wanted to forget. It was easy to forget, but I could not forget you, my first precious daughter, Jessica Lynn. 16 years passed, and in my wanderings here, I came across that valley again. It was raining. This time I did not turn away, but obeying heaven's command, I knelt beside the stones, stayed until dawn's early light. Oh, holy night, angels sang, the grip of night grew limp, and he appeared, and each soul felt its worth. He did not turn away, traumatized by pain, but stretched out his hand and placed it into the flame. Beyond his hand I saw the wrist impaled by my spear, pierced so deep with wounds, yet draws me near. Beyond his wrist a gaze, ablaze. Oh, that gaze ablaze. With such love it burst my breast, evoking deepest praise. Oh, death, where is your victory? Oh, grave, where is your sting? Captured with awe, I stared and stared, and then I knew that when I left, he had cared for you. Oh, Jessica, hardly your life clear forth of heaven was sent, and it broke out into a smile and went. So swift your days. A gift to us was lent. You now a daughter. And say, inextricably blend, will one day teach your father in some heavenly tent. Well, as Elsie said, God is a redeemer. Look at the next slide. And it's been a special song for us. So it's interesting, when we sang that song, in the hospital, the following Sunday, Don was sitting 3 rows behind, and I was in the front row, and for some reason it was the church song, and we sang it again. So when I looked at her and she looked at me, there was this wonderful bond. 15 years later, she was at church again. 4 rows behind me, I was there, and I played the same song. Yeah, it was pretty special. Okay, next. Next. After the song, keep going. So, tears of night transform into a shout of joy in the morning. Next song. So my friend Jim Ziegler works at Alta Mesa Cemetery. He discovered that Jessica's ashes had been taken there. So he has stone made for both my kids. And put on the verse, "We weep with you now, but joy comes in the morning." And he brought it to my house. So I have a place to go. So that's my backyard. And then, when I was teaching at Western Seminary, of course, I make everybody do poetry. And so poetry time comes. And a girl with a lot like Joy gets up, and I said, looked at her, I said, "You're Jessica. What's your middle name?" She said, "Jessica Lynn." So then I probed a little more. "What year are you born, Jessica?" She said, 1976. "Well, what month, Jessica?" "November." "What day?" "November 30. And so she read a poem. The Lord said to me, "Today you get to hear your daughter's voice. Just today. Just tell you love you." It's a little gift. Next slide. And it goes on and on. We had never celebrated Jessica's birthday. And so Emily says, "Why don't we celebrate Jessica's birthday?" So I said, "Yeah." We had a couple of the grandkids come over. So I called my other sister, my daughter, Jenny. I said, "Would you come over and give your sister Jessica a voice?" So I wrote a letter to Mom from Jessica from heaven. Because I've done this whole process. But it's been harder on my wife. She would tell you that when David died, something died in her, because you pray so hard for something to happen and it doesn't happen, so you think God doesn't really answer your prayers. And it was an all-night prayer meeting for David of all the women of the church. And I know everything that's happened in my life since is a result of that prayer meeting. And she would know that intellectually, but it's hard for her as the mom. So I wrote this letter from Jessica to her about thanking her mom. She never knew pain, but she only knew the mother's love. And then I said, and she says, "I know something you don't know. When people were praying," she says, "I watched it from heaven. Everything shut down for half an hour. Silence. And then this flurry of activity happened. And then who would have thought? A baby by Christmas?" So I just wanted my daughter to love me. My wife. So then this last, a year ago, February, we're at the beach, and Steve and Katie surprised me coming with their three kids because she just gave birth. And it was a miraculous, it was this day from heaven at Carmel Beach. I don't have it here, so I'll have to read it up here. And so this is Reese on the left, and then her little brother Ty, and he's totally oblivious to her, but she's just like following him, like, "Whatever you're doing, I'm gonna do. I'm gonna imitate my big brother." So I call this a day at the beach. And Carmel Beach was saturated in sun-soaked beauty when Katie and Steve arrived with their three cherubs. There was little about this day that did not give me cause to rejoice, perhaps even worship. Ty's endless energy quickly lost in mountains of sand, Reese slyly watching, imitating her big brother's every move. Tate snuggled still in Katie's cocoon, Emily, David, and Lori looking on as adoring grandparents. Standing at the water's edge, ankle deep in foam, captivated still by the receding fog bank, would have been sufficient to satisfy a day's longings. But there are castles to explore and track meets to run with Ty up and down the steep mountains of white as sand. He conquers them like a proud Philistine warrior while my pounding heart begs for a moment to recover. With no time to rest, Ty carries his chair up the mountain of sand, utterly oblivious to his sister in tow, takes his seat like a king peering over his vast domain. Happy children, weary joggers, shy lovers, and countless dogs who, like Ty, unleash their joy with no restraint. To his right sits Reese, a queen inserted into her brother's world. While Steve and I launch a wiry frisbee along the shoreline, Ty gets a frisbee lesson from Grandpa Dave,
Like an Olympic discus thrower, he winds his body tight as a spring and he lets it loose with a shout. The frisbee takes flight no matter what its trajectory. It's airborne, buoyed by Ty's incessant laughter. Refusing to rest, we take up baseball with sponge balls, a bat ridiculously too small, and a tiny basketball. Everyone is an instant all-star. When David comes to bat, he smashes the ball into the outfield of unsuspecting spectators. We conscript Elena and her dog Dylan to be our left fielders, and Sarah, who is waist-deep digging a hole with her two friends in center. Sarah was promoted to offense, and after going 4 for 4, we were amazed to discover she's into theater, not sports, a girl of multi-talents. There's far more joy to recount than I can remember. But the memory of holding Ty's hand while carrying Reese on my shoulders at the water's edge crowns the day with childlike pleasure. Time has not dampened my ability to feel as young as Ty, even with these aged bones. As the afternoon fades, we pull up stakes, gathering all the paraphernalia of our Bedouin tent. I have a photo of Emily sitting there in 1976, pregnant with Jessica. Emily and I would descend deeper into the Valley of the Shadow that year. But today, nostalgia and love break my heart wide open. As I see the mother of my children holding Tate, our sixth grandchild.
It's a very faithful God. So my whole purpose in life is just to help heal others, embrace their sorrow and find the joy of the God that we found. So we're going to turn you loose. And Elsie's really good. Just come up here, Elsie. First of all, I want you to know there's no rules for writing, except write little. So often when we turn people loose and they've never had a stage, it just all comes out, which is fine. But Elsie has some wonderful suggestions about helping people write poetry. I used to have your little slides. I don't have them anymore. So just give them some suggestions.
I'll just tell you what I tell the ladies in my Bible study. Just keep it simple. If you can't think of anything to write, just start off with a letter to God, dear God, and just start there. And be honest, be vulnerable. And if it helps you, I just tell the ladies, find an image, one image. It might be a box. It might be a roundabout. You know, when you're driving in England, those roundabouts? It could be an animal. It could be something in nature. But find an image that you can use to describe what you're feeling. And then use that to shape your poem. So we did this once at a retreat. And a woman, I'll never forget, she came. And her whole poem was about a box. And how she was in the box. And the walls were closing in. And it was beautiful. I've never forgotten that poem. So if that helps you, it's a very simple way to do it. Just take an image, write a letter to the Lord. That's about all I have to say.